Welcome to NTD News Today. Here are today's top stories. Beijing will increase tariffs on U.S. imports from 84% to 125% in retaliation against the U.S. decision to hike China duties to a total of 145%. And what the U.S. Trade Representative said about tariff negotiations with other countries today. The European Union negotiates with China on electric vehicle pricing. An agreement would replace the high tariffs. The new CEO of Intel invested in hundreds of Chinese companies, some with links to Chinese military. That's according to corporate filings. A fatal helicopter crash in the Hudson River killed all six aboard, including a family of five. Officials have identified the victims as they work to recover the wreckage and determine the cause. And in Washington, a plane carrying several lawmakers had a minor collision at Reagan Airport. President Trump is getting a physical exam at Walter Reed Medical Center today. It's considered a presidential tradition dating back over a century. And in golf, Justin Rose is the early leader at the Masters for the fifth time in his career. But will this be the year he gets the green jacket?
This is NTD News Today, live from our global headquarters in New York City.
Today is Friday, April 11th. I'm Stephanie Cox. Now, the latest in a tit-for-tat battle between the world's two largest economies. China has raised tariffs on U.S. goods to 125%. Chinese leader Xi Jinping made his first public comments on the escalating trade war, saying in a statement today that China is, quote, not afraid. Beijing said the new import rules will be enforced beginning tomorrow. China has indicated it does not intend to go higher than 125%, saying it would be meaningless to engage in further escalation. It comes after President Trump raised tariffs on China to 145%. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent previously criticized China for its retaliatory tariffs, saying it would ultimately hurt China more. He noted that China's exports to the United States are five times greater than U.S. exports to China. On Wednesday, Trump paused his latest round of tariffs for 90 days for all countries except China. White House officials say the president is waiting for Beijing to break the impasse, but Beijing has repeatedly refused to arrange a leader-level phone call. Xi Jinping has instead launched a week of high-stakes diplomacy with other trade partners. U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer said he will speak to his Taiwanese and Israeli counterparts today. He confirmed this during an interview with Fox News.
Right after I'm done with this TV spot, I'm going to be speaking with my counterpart in Israel. Over the last 2 days, I had a long discussion with the Vietnamese. We're speaking with the Taiwanese later today as well. I have a full dance card.
Greer said he was speaking with multiple countries. That's after Trump said yesterday he would temporarily lower the tariffs on dozens of countries. Greer stressed the importance of the United States diversifying its imports to make it less dependent on Chinese goods. He added, quote, we do import a lot from China, and that actually, to me, underscores the urgency of the situation. Greer was asked this morning to respond to Chinese regime leader Xi Jinping's remarks.
Well, I'm not going to make further comment this morning. Thank you, though.
Is the U.S. engaged in negotiations with China?
Not at this point.
The European Union and China have agreed to look into setting minimum prices for Chinese-made electric vehicles instead of tariffs imposed by the EU last year. A European Commission spokesperson said yesterday that the EU Trade Commission spoke with China's commerce minister. Both sides agreed to look into setting minimum prices, the spokesperson said. China's Commerce Ministry said in a statement that negotiations were set to start immediately. Previous minimum price deals agreed to by the EU have been for simple commodities rather than complex products such as cars. The EU increased tariffs on Chinese-built EVs to as much as 45% last October. The EU spokesperson added that the next meeting between European and Chinese officials is expected to be held in Beijing in July. Retired Lieutenant General Dan Kane will be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff after a confirmation vote early this morning. The vote was 60 to 25. The late vote came after delay tactics from Senate Democrats. That was a response to Trump's firing of former chairman C.Q. Brown, which they say was unjustified. Despite the protest, Kaine received bipartisan support with the Senate Armed Services Committee voting 23-4 to advance his nomination. During his confirmation hearing, Kaine vowed to serve apolitically and said he was willing to be fired if asked to carry out illegal orders. The House of Representatives passed the Senate-approved budget resolution yesterday, thus unlocking the next step in the reconciliation process. Our Washington correspondent Luis Martinez has the details.
What is your reaction to the passage of the budget resolution and Senator Thune saying this morning that he commits to $1.5 trillion in spending cuts?
I think what we're seeing right now is that Republicans have agreed to gut Medicaid in this country and put many other programs on the chopping block.
All Democrats voted against a budget resolution that would extend the 2017 tax cuts. The entire Republican conference, except Congressman Thomas Massie and Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, voted for the Senate-approved budget resolution.
But there's a lot of pain in those cuts. Some people are looking at the end of their political career. They're making a big decision. And let's see if it's the will of their people.
On paper, the resolution requires the Senate to cut $4 billion in government spending, while the House has a bottom line of $1.5 trillion in spending cuts.
So, Congressman, the verbal commitment from the Senate is that $1.5 trillion is the minimum spending cut.
Correct. They will. That is correct. That's what I heard.
Do you feel confident that the Senate will commit to the $1.5 trillion spending cut that the House Republican Conference is looking for?
I think so. I think Senator Thune and the other group of senators that I met with yesterday, they could have been more cordial and more honest about their situation. And their situation is no different from our speaker. You know, they have
budget resolution simply allows us to start the actual process of reconciliation. And the House can then jam the Senate. Look, if they don't like the end results of the cuts that we end up negotiating in reconciliation, then they don't have to vote for it.
Republican lawmakers in competitive districts believe that spending and tax cuts will deliver for the American people and gain Republican seats in Congress in next year's midterm elections.
Look, I think as long as we do our job, we deliver middle-class tax relief, if we protect our seniors and our most vulnerable, we're going to do great in the midterms. I think you'll see a big boon in the economy. We're already seeing trillions of dollars invested.
Republicans also celebrated this Thursday the return of Congresswoman Elise Stefanik in her new position as the chairwoman of the House Republican leadership.
That she, you know, wasn't able to go on and become the ambassador, U.N. ambassador from the United States. Super talented. I love to have her back on the Select China Committee.
Speaker of the House Mike Johnson remains committed to sending a reconciliation bill to the president's desk by Memorial Day. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Luis Eduardo Martinez, NTD News.
The House passed a bill yesterday requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote. It's the second time House Republicans have advanced such a measure for federal elections. Non-citizens are already barred from voting in federal elections, but supporters say the measure is needed to prevent migrants from voting and to boost confidence in elections. Critics say the bill would make it harder for people to vote if they're citizens but don't have the proper documents. They said it could decrease voter participation. Republicans will need the support of Democrats to pass the bill in the Senate. Still to come, investigations are underway for the tragic helicopter crash in New York City. All six passengers, including a family of five and the pilot, have perished. Another aviation incident yesterday. Two American Airlines planes clipped wings on a taxiway at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. Among the passengers were at least seven members of Congress, Representatives Gregory Meeks, Nick LaLota, Grace Meng, and Josh Gottheimer all confirmed they were aboard one of the planes.
We had pulled out. We were waiting on the runway. They were told we would take off in about 15 or 20 minutes. And as we were sitting there, suddenly the plane shook violently. We were hit by another plane. At first, you had no idea what was going on. And then it was clear pretty quickly. And the pilot came on and said, our wing had just been hit. And it looked like a piece had broken off and the FAA was coming out. So that's what happened. We all eventually went back to the gate. But thank God everyone is safe. Not something that should happen ever, especially at Washington National, where we've had so many incidents lately.
Congressman Adriano Espaillat and Richie Torres were also on board. American Airlines reported no injuries and said damage was limited to the winglets on both aircraft. The airline arranged for replacement planes to continue the passengers' flights. The FAA has launched an investigation, which comes at a time of heightened scrutiny of aircraft crashes and near collisions. Authorities, including the National Transportation Safety Board, are investigating Thursday's mid-afternoon helicopter crash that killed a family of five and the pilot. New York City Mayor Eric Adams said the children were 4, 8, and 10 years old, and that the 8-year-old's birthday was Friday.
At this time, all 6 victims have been removed from the water. And sadly, all 6 victims have been pronounced deceased. Again, we're praying for the families and our gratitude to the rescuers and the courage that was displayed in their dedication.
Oh my God. Siemens executive Augustin Escobar had been on vacation with his wife and 3 children when the rotary aircraft plunged into the Hudson River. Adams called the tragedy a real unfortunate situation. He said, "Our hearts go out to the family members." Photos posted on the helicopter company's website showed the couple and their children smiling as they boarded just before the flight took off. The cause of the crash is still under investigation. In another aviation incident, a small plane crashed this morning in South Florida near a major interstate highway and railroad tracks. The Boca Raton Police Department said in a social media post that several roads near the airport were closed near Interstate 95. Local media reported the plane was on fire. Firefighters were responding. It wasn't immediately known how many passengers were on the plane and whether there were any survivors. We'll have more details on this, though, as it develops. And as you just heard, investigations are underway looking back at the tragic helicopter crash in New York City, where all 6 passengers have perished. For the latest on what we know so far and the recovery efforts, we have retired U.S. Navy Captain Armin Kurdian and Black Hawk helicopter pilot and U.S. Army veteran Darren Gobb. Good to have you both with us. And let's begin with you, Darren. Yeah, great to have you both with us. Hey there. Let's start with you, Darren. Some reports say that these types of helicopters aren't required to have a black box, but we do have some footage of the fall. What does it indicate to you about what could have happened?
Yeah, hey, thanks, Steph. First of all, condolences out of the family of the of those 5 and the friends. That the picture's hard to see, the video's hard to see, but by looking at the video and by assessing it based on about 1,000 hours of flight time I have in that specific kind of aircraft, what I can tell you is that kind of aircraft could only go into something like that is that catastrophic if you have something along the lines of like a transmission failure or a major component, foreign object damage. So these things are very rare, but they are possible. And if they don't hit another object or like another aircraft in the sky or a building or something like that, the only way that something that bad can happen is for something major on board the aircraft to fail significantly. Essentially, it eats itself. And the main rotor could have come off and taken off the tail boom and tail rotor drive shaft. The transmission could have failed, which would have caused multiple cascading other failures. Or there could have been some other issue directly where the transmission connects to the drive shaft back to the tail rotor that could have started a cascading series of failures that would result in what you saw. But very rare, but it is certainly obviously very possible, but it's not like it's a fleet-wide problem. That aircraft is a very good aircraft.
Good to know. And yes, the footage is horrific to watch, but I'm glad to hear it's not that common or that much of a risk. But a witness reportedly said that they saw the tail and the main rotor coming off midair. Armin, do you have anything to add on this point?
Certainly. Good morning, Stefania. So basically, one of 2 things could have happened. Either there was a material failure, like something physically broke inside the aircraft, not an attachment point, something just cracked and broke apart, which might be something that you would not normally catch on a pre-flight inspection, or something that was not properly tightened, something came loose and eventually caused a series of cascading failures. Something like that would happen that could possibly cause both the rotor, the tail, and the main rotor to come off. The pilot may have may have only had a few seconds of knowledge that something was seriously wrong before he even had a chance to perhaps, completely disconnect the transmission from the rotor. But at that point, the vibrations may have been so bad that the aircraft might have been shaking so badly that he may not have even been physically able to perform these kinds of a situation. When the aircraft actually crashed into the water, you know, helicopters tend to invert when they go into the water. And there's a lot of training that I went through when I was in the Navy on trying to egress from helicopters. It's very dangerous. You're hanging upside down. You can't really see. You're disoriented. You have to egress safely. So I do believe, though, that once they pull this out of the water and the investigators from the NTSB start taking a look at this, I think they're going to have a pretty darn good idea of what happened within just maybe 48, 72 hours of it coming up.
And I do want to look at the rescue efforts and the investigation that's getting started. But following on from that, Darren, based on the video and the speculations that we've just laid out, was there much that you think the pilot could have done to save the helicopter?
No, this was simply not recoverable. I've been in aviation accidents myself as a result for a variety of reasons. But once you lose major components, you lose tail rotor effectiveness or control in any way. And regardless of the order of how things happened, if the main rotor system comes off the top, there's nothing that any pilot could do, no matter how good they are. And that's why it's so hard to see, because you know that they were the entire thing. They had zero control over this at that point.
All right. Now looking at the recovery efforts, Armin, and New York City Police said their response was swift and coordinated. Talk us through what apparatuses would have switched into gear to try to save the victims.
Well, the Hudson River is very highly trafficked, and the emergency responders, the police and fire have a lot of guys who are ready on standby, because this kind of thing can happen, whether, say, it's a boat that goes underwater or an aircraft crash or a vehicle, say, comes off of a bridge. You got to have these guys ready to go and get into the water. It's cold. It was daylight, at least, so they had that going for them, and it wasn't too far away from shore, so at least that was, you know, not a problem. But at the same time, with the violence of the impact onto the water, it's very likely I can't imagine a scenario where the passengers and the pilot would not have been at the very least knocked unconscious. And then with other impacts and being under the water for a period of time, you just with no oxygen, unfortunately, they were not going to be able to make it. But it is a testament to how quickly they actually did respond on scene. So there was other kind of accident where there might be a chance of survivors. I think you can rest assured that the New York City Police and Fire Department are going to be there with their boats and their dive crews and their lights and try to save those people.
Yeah. On that point, Darren, the FDNY Commissioner Robert Tucker said the FDNY and NYPD's response efforts showed the spirit of cooperation is alive and well between them and other agencies. How important is that from a morale standpoint and in a practical sense as well?
No, it's extraordinarily important. If you look at not only this accident, but what happened in Washington, D.C. and then Philadelphia, where you've actually seen a very good job of coordination happen between different police, fire, search and rescue, port authorities, FAA, you have to have those, I guess you could say, chain of command in line. You have to have instructions clearly understood. You have to know who's in charge, and they have to work together for a common cause in order to, first of all, attempt to save lives, and then second of all, quickly move on to clearing the area and doing an effective investigation. And that's what good coordination, cooperation means, because they're going to spend more time focused on what's important and less time fighting amongst themselves, trying to figure out who is supposed to do what and who's ultimately in charge.
Yeah. And Armin, back to you. NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch says the NTSB, FBI, and local authorities are all investigating. There are questions, of course, about the maintenance protocols at the company operating the ride, which is New York Helicopters. I do know that NTSB requires a checklist of items and personnel, and you had mentioned that something could have failed that wasn't on a pre-flight checklist or protocol. What would you look at first in such an investigation?
Well, it's been mentioned, I would take a look, first of all, with considering how localized the crash was, it's very likely that they'll be able to recover most of the parts, if not pretty much all the major components, of the aircraft and try to reconstruct it and rebuild it to see what's actually going on. One of the most telltale signs, and if you go back to, I believe it was the Alaska Airlines, where the door or that hatch kind of blew off mid-flight, you'll be able to see where metal was torn, where metal was ripped because the stresses actually pulled it apart. Or if something was actually missing, you might see a perfect hole where there was no stress because there was nothing to get pulled off. So that is going to be a telltale sign that they're going to look for as they go through it. But they also have very good experience, and they will know if something failed in flight due to a material failure in flight or an aerodynamic stress, vice and impact stress when the aircraft actually impacts the water and goes inverted. And the most important aspect is why they need to do this very quickly and have a good preliminary idea is because if there is some kind of material failure, I know the Bell 206 went through an upgrade program about 18, 19 years ago. So you're going to want to know whether that upgrade was done on this helicopter and if it was done properly. And if there are any possible issues that weren't necessarily tied to specific maintenance on that aircraft, you're going to want to get that information out to the rest of the Bell 206 fleet because they're going to want to do an inspection to make sure that if this is a potential issue to happen on another aircraft, that it doesn't happen.
Darren, what would you be looking to in the investigation?
Yeah, very similar to what Armin said is you're looking at, first of all, the materials on the ground, see if there's material fatigue, see if there's a component failure, see if there's a manufacturing problem with regards to how the individual pieces are made, because there could be a problem in one of those. And that's where you start wondering about fleet-wide maintenance of that kind of aircraft. Is this a common problem among the rest of the fleet? You take that, compare it with the investigation of the reassembled aircraft, then simultaneously they'll be looking at the maintenance records that are kept on the aircraft with the company, make sure they adhere to the standards, and then they'll go through all the rest of it to see if there are any other contributing factors from pilot experience, fatigue, weather, and you name it. There are many different parts and pieces they'll look at, but I think in the end you're going to find out, I agree that you're going to find out fairly quickly, and you're probably going to find out this is a mechanical issue that the specifics of which could take a bit to find out exactly, but they'll want to know quickly whether or not this is an item that failed that is a same item on multiple aircraft on the same fleet.
Certainly an extreme tragedy with this event, but hopefully if there is something found, it will lead to quick correction for all future flights. Thank you so much for your time today, Armin Kurdi and Darren Gobb. Good to speak with you both.
Thanks, Stephanie.
All right, and next up, President Trump is getting the first physical of his second term at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center today, also known as the President's Hospital. Due to bad weather, it will be a motorcade ride instead of Marine One flight for the president. It marks his first annual physical in his second administration. It will also be the first public information on Trump's health since an assassination attempt against him during a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania in 2024. Trump is set to turn 79 in June. He'll be 82 at the end of his term. Ryan Routh now faces additional charges. He's the suspect accused of trying to assassinate Donald Trump on a golf course last fall. Florida's attorney general has charged Routh with state terrorism and attempted murder charges. He thanked the leadership of U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel yesterday.
We now have a federal government willing to work together to pursue justice. Attempting to take the life of a former president and a leading presidential candidate isn't just an attack on one man. This was a political attack against our Republican form of government and our shared American values. We cannot allow justice to be delayed or denied. And thanks to the president, our U.S. Attorney General, and the FBI director, we are moving forward in our pursuit. Our statewide prosecutors will work to hold this evil man accountable and keep Florida safe, strong, and free.
According to prosecutors, Ryan Routh plotted to kill Trump as he golfed at his West Palm Beach golf course in September. Secret Service officers spotted Routh before he allegedly aimed his rifle at an agent who then opened fire. Routh dropped his weapon and fled before being apprehended shortly after. The 59-year-old is jailed on a number of federal charges, including attempting to assassinate a major presidential candidate, assaulting a federal officer, and being a felon in possession of a firearm. Routh is due in court on the federal charges in September. The Supreme Court says the Trump administration must facilitate the return of a man mistakenly deported to El Salvador, but the High Court stopped short of requiring it. Salvadoran national Kilmar Abrego Garcia was sent to prison in El Salvador last month, along with hundreds of alleged Venezuelan gang members. But in 2019, an immigration judge granted Abrego Garcia protected status, meaning the government could not deport him. That was over fears that he would face persecution from local gangs in his home country. The Trump administration says he's part of the MS-13 gang, which his attorneys deny. The Justice Department did not provide a deadline for Abrego Garcia's return to the U.S. A federal judge is allowing the Trump administration's new immigration registration policy to move forward. It includes mandates like requiring non-citizens age 14 and older to register with the government, submit biometric data like fingerprinting, and carry proof of registration. Failure to do so could result in criminal charges. The policy was challenged in a lawsuit filed in March by numerous immigrant advocacy groups. They argued that the rules would disproportionately harm non-citizens, especially those who have already been screened and vetted by the federal government. However, the judge ruled yesterday that challengers failed to show how the policy would harm immigrants in a way that would make it appropriate for the courts to intervene. The policy is taking effect today. Elon Musk expects the government to save $150 billion in fiscal year 2026 through a reduction of waste and fraud. Speaking at a White House cabinet meeting, Musk praised the leadership, the cabinet, and the DOGE team. He said some of the fraud uncovered included people getting unemployment insurance when they haven't been born yet. President Trump said he bought a Tesla in a show of support for Musk.
Look, he's sitting here, and I don't care. I don't need Elon for anything other than I happen to like him. But I'm telling you, this guy did a fantastic job. I don't need his car. I actually bought one. And they said, oh, did you get a bargain? No. I said, give me the top price. I paid a lot of money for that car. But honestly, he makes a great car. You know what I do with it? I let the people in the office drive around in it. Just a show of support. Because, you know, he's done a fantastic job, but he hasn't been treated properly.
Trump said he hoped DOGE team members would stay around for the long haul, saying they've been finding things nobody would have expected. Also at the cabinet meeting, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi said her department arrested four people for targeting Tesla property. She said they each face up to 20 years in prison. The Department of Government Efficiency has posted its latest findings on potential waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government. According to DOGE, an initial survey revealed hundreds of millions of dollars in phony unemployment insurance claims since 2020. DOGE reported more than 24,000 people over 115 years old claimed $59 million in benefits over the last 5 years. And 28,000 people between 1 and 5 years old claimed $254 million. DOGE says almost 10,000 people with birth dates over 15 years in the future claimed $69 million in unemployment. And in one instance, an individual with a birthday in 2154 claimed $41,000 in benefits. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth signed a memorandum yesterday to cut $5.1 billion in Defense Department contracts. Some of the cuts include consulting contracts and what he calls non-essential activities like DEI and climate issues.
We're signing a memo right now, directing the termination of $5.1 billion in DOD contracts. Not million, that's with a B. $5.1 billion in DOD contracts for ancillary things like consulting and other non-essential services. Today's cuts bring our running total to nearly $6 billion in wasteful spending over the first 6 weeks of the DOD DOGE effort here at the Defense Department.
Some cuts include $1.8 billion in consulting contracts with various private firms, including Accenture, Deloitte, and Booz Allen. Hegseth is also cutting a $500 million Navy contract with Accenture to resell third-party enterprise cloud IT services. He also announced cuts totaling over $500 million in funding to Northwestern University and Cornell University. He cited what he called the school's tolerance for anti-Semitism and their support for DEI programs. Hegseth said the savings from the cuts will go toward better health care for, quote, our war fighters and their families. A judge is set to decide whether to proceed with resentencing hearings for Eric and Lyle Mendez. The two brothers were convicted of murdering their parents at their Beverly Hills home in 1989. The Menendez brothers were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. While the defense argued they acted out of self-defense after years of sexual abuse by their father, prosecutors said the brothers killed their parents for a multi-million dollar inheritance. Los Angeles County's previous district attorney, George Gascon, sought resentencing for the brothers before he lost re-election to tough-on-crime candidate Nathan Hochman in November. Gascon had asked a judge to change the brothers' sentence to 50 years to life, which would make them immediately eligible for release under California law. Hochman is opposing their resentencing. Coming up, a U.S. representative meets with Russian President Vladimir Putin today. What they're set to discuss regarding Ukraine and President Trump. Countries warn of Chinese hacking operations targeting cell phones and mobile phones and devices, allowing access to enormous amounts of data. Supporters of South Korea's ousted president greet him at his home. The welcome follows the leader's recent removal from office. I'm Stephanie Cox, and this is World Watch. A U.S. representative is meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin today. Special envoy Steve Witkoff is in St. Petersburg, where he met Putin's investment envoy earlier this morning. Putin is in St. Petersburg as well today. The Kremlin says that's for a key meeting about the development of the Russian Navy. While in the same city, Putin also met with Witkoff. They were scheduled to talk about the Ukraine conflict and potential peace. Before the meeting, a spokesperson for the Kremlin downplayed the planned talks, saying no breakthroughs were expected. However, the two men also discussed a Trump-Putin meeting. Such a meeting could eventually bring more significant changes. As Witkoff works closer towards peace, the Ukraine Defense Contact Group is meeting in Brussels. Western allies announced pledging more than $24 billion to Ukraine. Britain's defense secretary calls this a record boost in military funding for Ukraine. He added that allies are surging that support to the front line to fight. But the defense secretary gave no breakdown of that large figure. In the past, Ukraine has complained that some countries repeat old offers at such pledging conferences, or that they fail to deliver real arms and ammunition worth the money they promise. Last week, NATO said its members provided $21 billion so far in the first 3 months of the year. The European Union today said that more than $26 billion have been committed. A Russian-American woman, freed by Moscow, arrived back in the United States late last night. Ksenia Karolina was sentenced to 12 years in prison in Russia last year for donating $50 to a charity aiding Ukraine. She landed at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland at around 11 p.m., where she was greeted by her fiancé. Russia's main security service said Arthur Petrov was released as part of the swap. He was arrested in Cyprus in 2023 on charges of smuggling sensitive microelectronics to Russia and extradited to the U.S. a year later. Karolina's release is the latest in a series of high-profile prisoner exchanges between Russia and the U.S. in the last 3 years and the second since Trump took office. A U.S. official told Reuters that Special Envoy Steve Witkoff brought up the case of Karolina with Putin during a call last week and that Putin's reaction was to, quote, do something as a goodwill gesture because he wants to settle the war. The U.S. ambassador to Ukraine is stepping down. Bridget Brink has held that post since May of 2022. Her departure comes at a delicate time in U.S. relations with Ukraine. 6 weeks ago, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky clashed with President Donald Trump during a White House meeting, and the U.S. temporarily stopped sending weapons to Ukraine and suspended intelligence sharing. But the two sides resumed negotiations on a minerals deal, which is happening today in Washington. The State Department confirmed Brink's departure yesterday, but she hasn't commented on it. It's not known if she was fired or she resigned voluntarily. Also not clear is exactly when she'll vacate the position. The United States has imposed new sanctions targeting Iran's so-called shadow fleet. The measures against Tehran's oil transportation network come 2 days before negotiations over the nation's nuclear program. The State Department said the sanctions are part of President Trump's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the United States will hold direct talks with Iran over its nuclear program in Oman tomorrow. President Trump said earlier this week Iran would be in great danger if the negotiations were successful. Sanctions are also being imposed on a Chinese company which operates an oil terminal near Shanghai. According to the State Department, the facility has received Iranian crude oil at least 9 times between 2021 and 2025, including from U.S. sanctioned vessels. Iran said today it would give talks with the United States tomorrow a genuine chance. It follows comments from a State Department spokesperson saying the Saturday meeting will determine whether or not Iran is serious. President Trump confirmed earlier this week that the two countries will meet to begin talks over Iran's nuclear program. He said Iran could not have a nuclear weapon. Former South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol returned to his home today after moving from his official residence following his removal from office. Crowds of supporters turned out to greet his motorcade. Hundreds had gathered outside the gates of the official residence, where Yoon briefly stopped to hug and shake hands with supporters. Video footage showed Yoon donning a red Make Korea Great Again baseball cap. Yoon was then driven in a motorcade with his wife to his private apartment in a 37-story building in Seoul. South Korea's Constitutional Court upheld Yoon's impeachment last Friday, capping 4 months of unprecedented constitutional turmoil. His removal from office stemmed from his short-lived attempt to impose martial law in December. The Trump administration putting a 90-day pause on all reciprocal tariffs, but doubling down on 145% duties on China. How are everyday Americans viewing the trade war? NTD Sam Wong was out on the National Mall in D.C. to hear from them.
Right now, it seems like dozens of countries are trying to come to the negotiating table with President Trump. So what do you make of President Trump's strategy here, I guess?
Well, he's obviously trying to force our hands, you know, and I do believe there is a huge deficit in our trade. And I know there's a lot of countries coming to the table and he's paused some tariffs, but I don't think China will be one of them.
I just believe that President Trump is going to make us industrious again and self-supportive.
This nation is $37 trillion in the hole, and that we need to do something. The government and the people in government have been putting it aside for generations, and we finally have someone in the House, in the White House, that's going to do something and make a difference, and I want to stand behind him.
I think it was pretty smart. I think, you know, he laid down his markers. The people that are willing to do that will work out fair deals.
But I do look for it to get a little rougher and a little tougher. So I'll pull up my britches and hold by him and hope it makes it okay.
And President Trump is now temporarily pausing tariffs on dozens of countries, but with the notable exception of China. So what does this say about the Trump administration's priorities right now?
America first. For once.
And our medications, our software, all this stuff is developed and made in China, and we are so dependent upon them, we need to turn that around. And hopefully these tariffs will somehow bring that to a change. And also, I think to myself, if China doesn't want to play ball, there's other countries out there that will.
You know, the trade deficit of $1.2 trillion with China on an annual basis is not sustainable.
Well, I think Trump has always had a problem with China. I think China has been a problem for a long time, but nobody's wanted to address it. I know a lot of things are made in Taiwan that the United States needs, so I think they're apt to protect that country. But I think China is just taking the wait-and-see approach with President Trump, because I don't think President Trump wants to mess around.
I just trust and hope that he knows what he's doing and the people that is giving the information that it works out for us.
U.S. port operators and shippers are calling on President Trump to back off on proposed port fees on Chinese vessels. His proposed plan to impose port fees of up to $3.5 million on China-linked commercial carriers could take effect as soon as April 17th. Under the proposal, ships operated by Chinese companies would be charged $1 million, while ships built in China would pay $1.5 million per port call. The proposal was heavily criticized by shipping and ports representatives. U.S. shippers say the fees would disproportionately harm American-owned carriers. U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer clarified on Tuesday that not all port fees would be implemented. Corporate filings show the new CEO of Intel has invested in hundreds of Chinese tech firms, including at least 8 with links to the Chinese military. Lip-Bu Tan became CEO of the U.S.'s largest chipmaker last month. The findings have raised questions among some investors and complicates the issue of Intel's efforts to revive its business. Intel manufactures cutting-edge chips for the U.S. Department of Defense. Intel is also the only U.S.-based company making the most advanced computer chips in the world. But Tan controls more than 40 Chinese companies and funds, as well as having minority stakes in over 600 via investment firms he manages or owns. In many instances, he shares minority stake ownership with Chinese regime entities. Intel declined to comment on the matter. A spokesperson said Tan completed a questionnaire that requires disclosure of potential conflicts of interest. Several countries' intelligence agencies warn of an increasing threat from the Chinese regime. They say Beijing's spy services are using applications to hack into mobile phones and that the hacking is aimed at targets of the Chinese Communist Party. An advisory issued this week warned of the growing threat posed by malicious surveillance software from a company with ties to China's Ministry of Public Security. The advisory was signed by cybersecurity agencies in Britain, the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and Germany. According to Britain's National Cybersecurity Center, those most at risk include people connected to Taiwan independence, Tibetan rights, Uyghur Muslims, and other minorities in the Xinjiang region, democracy advocates, including those in Hong Kong, and the Falun Gong spiritual practice. The warning comes amid increasing tensions surrounding Taiwan, including Chinese military drills around the island and a U.S. commitment to deterring Chinese aggression in the region. The Chengdu-based contractor was linked to the deployment of a pair of distinct hacking software packages. They were tracked as Bad Bazaar and Moonshine and used to pull sensitive information from mobile devices while also giving hackers remote access to devices' cameras, microphones, and location data. The warnings build on previous cybersecurity reports of hacking software used by the same company going back several years. Coming up in golf, just in, Rose is the early leader at the Masters again. Will it hold up this time? NTD's Dave Martin joins us to discuss. And now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin. Dave, plenty going on right now, but let's start in golf as the Masters enters their second round play today. What's atop the leaderboard?
Yeah, Justin Rose still ahead in the leaderboard, say, earlier in the second round. Now, he led yesterday after one. He shot a 7-under 65. That's actually the fifth time he's led this event after one round. But unfortunately for him, he has yet to win it. Maybe this will be his year. So right now, today, though, he's a minus two through 12 holes. Still has a three-shot lead over second place. Now, not far behind him, you've got number one ranked Scottie Scheffler. He's number one ranked player in the world. 4-under, but he has yet to start the second round play today. I think he starts at like 120 or something like that. And meanwhile, second-ranked Rory McIlroy, he's at 1-under. He's tied for 17th right now. But anyway, McIlroy and Scheffler are the odds-on favorites to win this tournament. Now, one player to watch for today, 65-year-old Fred Couples. Now, Couples won this event all the way back in 1992, 33 years ago. Yesterday, though, he became the second oldest player ever to break par at any round of the Masters, shot a 1-under. Now, should he make the weekend cut today, he will break his own record as the oldest to do so. Right now, he is 1-under through one hole in the second round. So that'd be kind of exciting to watch there.
Yeah, all right. Well, regarding this event, the Masters has long been billed as a tradition unlike any other. What exactly does CBS mean by that?
You know, it really is unique. You know, unlike most events that really squeeze every dollar out of the fans, the Masters, they really make this event as great as they can for the fans and for the players. An example, their concession stand items. Prices are dirt cheap. You know, sandwiches are between like $1.50 and $3. You got breakfast items for the same prices. The most expensive thing on the menu is, I think, domestic beers are like $6. Wine is $6. The entire 27 menu item can be had for $77. That's less than $3 per item. Wow. Most sporting events gouge you right there at the concession stands. Now, meanwhile, a four-day ticket to watch this event goes for $450. Of course, you compare that to a Super Bowl, it's a bargain. A single day pass is 140, but you have to enter a lottery to get these tickets. You know, there's only maybe, I think, 40,000 people come in each day. there's several million that entered this lottery. So you have like less than a 1% chance at getting it. But if people do get it, if they sell it on the resell it on the secondary market, it goes for like 10 times the price. So they could easily charge way more if they chose to do it. TV coverage done by CBS, as we've already said, they don't actually pay the Masters for it. Now, this is according to a Golf Digest article. CBS actually sends a production bill to the Masters. The Masters then passes that on to their corporate sponsors. If you've ever watched their event, there's only 4 minutes of commercials per hour. I mean, that's way less than any kind of TV event, for sure. And of course, the event itself, the winner gets a green jacket right on the course. As soon as they win, they have this whole ceremony where the previous winner puts on them. It's like you enter this exclusive club. So it really is a tradition unlike any other, for sure.
It sure is. Now, looking at NBA news, there are just 3 days left in the regular season. But looking at the Western Conference, there are 5 playoff spots still up for grabs, right?
Yeah, 5 teams are within 1 game each of each other with two games played. You've got the Nuggets and Clippers, 1 game ahead of the Warriors, Grizzlies, and Timberwolves. And those are spots 4 through 8 in the Western Conference. Now, no one wants those 7 and 8 spots, because if you get in the 7 through 10 spots, you get in that very confusing play-in round the next week, and you could possibly miss the playoffs if that doesn't go well for you. So even the Clippers or Nuggets, who are tied for 4th right now, if things don't go well these next 2 days and next week, they miss out on the playoffs entirely. So anyway, tonight, the Timberwolves host the Nets looking for a win. Warriors, Clippers, they're both on the road. They need a win as well. Grizzlies and Nuggets play each other tonight in Denver. So a lot of important games still to go with just a couple days left in the regular season.
A lot going on. A lot going on. All right. We'll look forward to hearing more. Dave, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And looking at springtime news, pick your own tulips fields are trending in northern Italy. Several dozen of them let visitors pick their own flowers directly from the soil. What fun. NTD's Andrew Thomas has more on the springtime florals.
This field outside Milan bursts with vivid oranges, yellows, and purples. With the arrival of spring, dozens of tulip fields have opened to the public, offering visitors the chance to pluck their own flowers directly from the ground. The trend began 9 years ago when Dutchman Edwin Komen decided to create Italy's first tulip U-pick park.
They come here, they take their basket or their bucket, and we give a little explanation. The people are walking, picking their favorite tulip to take home and put in their face, and people are also making photos.
The tulip is a unique flower that matures underground during the cold winter. Massimo Labra, scientific director of the Italian National Biodiversity Center, explains the process.
Tulips are not only beautiful and wonderful, but also clever plants. They are called geophytes, that is, they spend most of their time covered by the ground, in the subsurface. And they are alive. These bulbs are real plants. Then, at the beginning of spring, with a little water, we see that the apex immediately grows quickly and blooms.
Labra also describes how the flowers play a critical role in maintaining biodiversity in Italy.
The flower is a bit like a supermarket for a pollinator. So, the more different flowers there are, not just roundels, those that bloom early, those that bloom late, are a huge supermarket for all these pollinators that travel along our roads, that pollinate flowers from our balconies, our terraces, to the fields of roundels. And that represent one of the most important elements for our agriculture and for our future.
The tulips are a huge draw and an escape from the grind of city life.
Every year I come here together with my friends, even several times. Usually we have to hurry because the best flowers are all picked within a few weeks. We managed to come close to the opening a week later. This time it worked out really well for me. It's beautiful.
It's a time for recreation. It is a way to get away from the city and the pollution and concrete.
The flowers are colorful and convey a good mood, so it's also a good time to spend it together.
Last fall, Komen planted 650,000 bulbs. Some 50,000 visitors are expected in the 5 to 6 weeks the field will be open. Andrew Thomas, NTD News.
Stay with us. We'll be broadcasting the White House press briefing right after this break.